Hercules, that greatest of all Greek heroes, possessed a mighty and magical bow that he bequeathed to a man named Philoctetes. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Sailing from Greece to invade Troy to bring back Helen, Philoctetes received a wound on his foot that became foul and festering. So foul and festering, in fact, that people couldn't stand being near him, couldn't stand being on the same ship as he was. And so the decision was made to maroon him alone on a deserted island with only his bow for company. But the Trojan War went badly for the Greeks, and they knew that they could not win without Philoctetes' bow. The question was how to get it back from Philoctetes, who, after 10 years on his island, was bitterly angry at Odysseus, Menelaus, and the other Greek leaders who had left him. Their solution was to send Achilles' son, Neoptolemus, to pose as a friend and procure the bow through subterfuge, thus putting the young man in a moral quandary. Do whatever it takes to help the Greek cause, even if it means lying? Or to be honest with Philoctetes and bring him to Troy along with his bow? Which choice was the courageous one? Sophocles, the ancient Greek playwright, wrote a version of Philoctetes' story, and so has modern author, Nobel Prize winner, Seamus Heaney. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, Dr. Virginia Arbery discussed the story of Philoctetes in Heaney's The Cure at Troy. Here are her remarks.
This is a play that we have to feel our way into. We can analyze it with respect to the many exchanges of the bow, of the turn, and the attitude of Neoptolemus twice. First, he doesn't want to participate in the Odyssean scheme for the sake of the Greek people. Then he concedes. Then he becomes the friend, which seems to be a higher order, a moral conflict posed for him of even a higher order than he initially felt, between betraying a friend and doing his duty, which if he doesn't do it, will make him a traitor. So he's in this quandary. So we have a kind of play that not only concentrates on a young man's education, but also the very interesting pair of paradigmatic examples. We said that virtue is dependent on having an example, a spoudaio, as Aristotle puts it, a mature man to look at. We have two mature men. Neither one of them are really an example. And we have a boy who's an orphan, who has no father. So you have two examples. One, a man who's been abandoned for 10 years, who stinks, right? Who has a very smelly foot that Scholl's spray won't help. Ordained by the gods, a snake bite, right? And we also have the effects of that wound making him bitter, unable to reconcile his fate in any way that seems to be a higher purpose, such as saving the Achaeans, and no way in which he can forgive those who have abandoned him because of it. You know, a wound that has stopped the sacrifices from being able to be offered because everybody's retching, right? It's something like the end of Antigone where the sacrifices can't be offered. You don't have that medium, the smoke rising, the sacrificial place in which we live, the metoxy, the medium, the between in which we live as human beings. So there, you know, there's serious reasons for the wound. So that's one example, a man who nurses his wounds, who, as Heaney wonderfully translates on page one, people so deep into their own self-pity buoys them up. People so staunch and true, they're fixated, shining with self-regard like polished stones. And then the other figure, of course, is Odysseus, who's a man who had at one time the passion of right instincts, as he said in his youth, but gave that up to be the fox, right? He knows that brains and using words as a kind of implement of force are just as effective, if not more effective, in getting one's aim achieved. So in those two paradigmatic examples, it's interesting because what is virtue supposed to hit? The metaphor that Aristotle gives us, it's kind of going to be the theme of the day, I think, is the archer, the bow, with the arrow that if it hits its mark, which is that midpoint between two extremes, say again, in the case of courage, between foolhardiness and pusillanimity, if it hits its mark, it's virtue, right? Hitting the mark. So the bow itself is an image of hitting the mark. But how is this young man supposed to hit the mark when he has two what you might call defective examples of the spudaio, of the mature man? So the young man, he wants to be a gentleman, right? This is the goal of education. It should be our goal. It was the goal in the Athenian world, right? You want to be this word again, kalos, beautiful or noble, and this means and. And you also want to be good. Agathon is the good. So the good man who acts in those beautiful ways that the courageous man acts is the gentleman. And one of the ways in which the gentleman is cultivated, of course, and this is what the education journey is, it seems to me, in this tragedy, is not only through seeing the good man to emulate, but it's also through a developed then sense of shame when one falls short of the mark, when you can't do it, when you don't do it in a very serious way, right? And so this word shame is interesting too. It's the word autos, which is the same root word for awe. So if you have awe, you will then have shame, because you'll know when you have been irreverent to that which you should hold in awe. Mr. Washit talked about Plato's take on courage, and in a wonderful translation of the Republic, we get it in a very vivid way. Riemann Larsson suggests that courage, in the way that Plato's talking about it, is preserving the things which one should hold in awe. Right? Now, the laws should be held in awe. The city, of course, is what he's talking about. You have to hold the laws in awe. But in this case, and in, say, the case of Antigone, and, say, the case of Sophie Scholl, we have defective laws in which what you should hold in awe is actually higher than the law, where there's a conflict between the common law or the positive law, translated different ways, in the regime, whatever it might be. So without shame, you can't have a city. In a famous dialogue by Plato called the Protagoras, Zeus looks at men and what has developed after their creation, and he says to Hermes, something's going on, these men are all killing each other. They were formed in a way that isn't complete. I think something was left out. And the suggestion is that what was left out was shame. And without shame, you can't have friendship. You can't really have a cohered city. So he sends Hermes down to give those human beings shame. Now, we have a problem in this play as we feel our way into it. It's kind of like the same problem in my favorite movie, which has the best music ever, The School of Rock, with Jack Black. Hey. And what does Jack Black want? I know, don't judge me. Bye-bye. He wants to stick it to the man, right? Stick it to the man. I saw that movie right when I wanted to stick it to the man. It wasn't my husband. It was the man I worked for. Oh, I wanted to stick it to the man. And I was reading this play around the same time, and yes! Understand Philoctetes. Hey, how are you? So, you know, something's getting in the way of this development that is necessary to Neoptolemus, who's been asked to do something quite awful, right, for the sake of the army, for the sake of the Greeks. Now, the way the play is staged, it seems to me, is to make us think about a stage. We get that word many times. We get the word rehearsal. So we're supposed to also, I think, be thinking about the stage, and we're supposed to be thinking, I think, about Odysseus as a kind of director, right? You're going to go there, Neoptolemus, you're going to act this part, right? I'm going to have somebody looking on you to make sure you're acting the part. And it's going to be so successful that we're going to get Philoctetes to give us the bow upon which the whole surrender of Troy depends. So you act your part. So let's look on page 10 a minute. You can see what I mean. Neoptolemus says, as he's being set up to do this, you don't think lying undermines your life? Not if it will save life and save the day. You can look me in the eye and still say that. Remember later, Neoptolemus can't look Philoctetes in the eye. You can look me in the eye and still say that. Scruples are self-indulgence at this stage. So what stage is it? Why must he go to Troy? A little bit later on page 53, there's the awareness here of being seen as you're as an actor on the stage. You're being seen. You're not only being seen by the other actors, but you're being seen by the audience, and in this case we have this reference to the gods, Philoctetes. The gods have their eyes on him, and that's why he can't get off the hook. He knows all this solidarity with the Greeks is sham. The only real thing is the thing he lives for, his own self-respect. At this point, you know that he's making Neoptolemus think about what really is his guiding rudder. And then there is the second bow exchange. So how you appear, what you look like, what Stan was talking about, Dr. Grove last night when he was talking about mimesis or imitation. What are your actions imitating in the soul? Right? So you're imitating something on the visible level on stage. But the play stays with you because it's imitated something in the action of your soul. Some direction, some choice, some aim that is either whole or defective. So I think this is a very powerful play because it pits two goods together in front of a young man who has to participate in two realms, which both of which seem less than gentlemanly. And what I think one of the things that we have to see is his agitation in this fix. We've talked about the ethics, we've talked about the politics, we've talked about Plato and several of his dialogues. But Aristotle's Rhetoric is really the best book on psychology. It is the seminal book on psychology. If you want to hear about the emotions, I think, in a much more full-bodied way than Thomas Aquinas, read Aristotle's Rhetoric. It's just rich. What sorts of things, this is chapter 6 of book 2, what sorts of things make people feel ashamed or shameless, and in whose presence, and what their condition is, will be clear from the following. Let shame be understood as a certain pain or agitation over bad deeds, present, past, or future, that appear to bring one into disrepute, and let shamelessly be a certain belittling and indifferent attitude towards these same things. So, if shame is, as defined then, necessarily, shame is felt at bad deeds, either in oneself or of people one cares about, deeds that seem to be ugly. So if we think of virtue as that kalos, that beautiful deed, the other, the opposite, the shameless deed is kakos, ugly, right? Nothing you want to live with, though Odysseus says, remember, you'll get over it, right? A little bit like Ismene, and back to Antigone. Well, I won't participate now, and the gods will forgive me later, right? We can get over it. Or a little bit like the temptation of more, it seems to me, to the young girl who's undermining at every step her chance to live up to her idea, kind of beating down of the idea. And of course, this leads to his self-disgust, to Neoptolemus' self-disgust. It says this on page 49. You might want to look at that. Oh, do you want to read that for us, please? You're such a good reader.
It's more like self-disgust. No, One false move, one move that's not your own, and everything goes to the bad.
This is not you. Whose son was ever more like himself or them before them?
I'll just be seen for what I am. I just can't face it.
Face what? What false move? What do you mean? All right, so can you face yourself? This whole idea of facing this self-disgust, right? It could be a very interesting meditation on the self-disgust that is caused in this young man. And then we'd have to ask, you have to ask yourself, what's the point where he can't bear it anymore and where he realizes he has to be true to this friendship? And then as a corollary, so that he's no longer two-faced, as Philoctetes tells him. As a corollary, what happens to Philoctetes? Is it just Hercules coming and the big boom, the volcanic event on Lemnos that changes him, or is something else changing him, right? Is it just a deus ex machina, as they say, that changes Philoctetes? What moves him to trust again, to believe again, right? So Dr. Grove talks so much about hope, and we have to see what gives him hope, because he's not going to change from that space of polishing his wounds, which he wears like a badge, right? He's not going to move from that space unless he has another vision of everything that's happened. When can he accept that vision? How does that happen in the play, so that his wound does not become more important to him than his desire to be part of that vision, that new hope, which is a communal hope, right? It's not a private hope. He has to move from the private that he's been put in, he's been placed in, he's been abandoned there, back to the public. Well, how does he do that? Yeah, so the whole staging of this, I think, is very interesting. And of course, our playwright, Seamus Heaney, who's the great Irish poet who won the Nobel Prize for Literature, as you know, he gets a little too literal at the end, doesn't he? When he has the whole Irish predicament mapped out for us. You know, if you're a widow, if you're if you're one of the Irish Republican Army and you're behind bars and you're nursing your wounds, that long history, if you've been to Ireland, if you know anybody connected with that long history, you know how the Irish have cause to nurse their wounds very much, you know, but how important Heaney thought it was to get past the wound. And I want to say one more thing about the wound. And it's interesting that the image for virtue, once again, is the bow and arrow. So remember, Odysseus says, I'm the man who can string the bow. If you know the story of the Odyssey, he comes home and there's the bow test that Penelope devises, and whoever can string the bow and shoot it through 12 axes right at the point where it meets the base, that will be the man who gets her. Well, her husband is the only one who can do it, so it's great. None of those inferior suitors get her. So he praises himself about his ability to be the bowsman, right? There's that reference also to Teucer, right? The one who's also the bowsman. But the bow and the arrow, as we know, which almost hits Odysseus, right? If Neoptolemus hadn't stopped him, is also the bow, the arrow that causes the wound. And these are miraculous arrows, right? They're supposed to hit. So I was just meditating a little bit on this, and I don't know if it's useful to you, but think about it, what it means. If virtue is hitting the mark, if it's just the right point between two extremes, and it's the arrow hitting the mark, there's also involved in virtue a wounding of some sort. Something that could be the opposite of what seems to be a positive aim and target. Does virtue carry within itself a wound? That's part of my question here. And if so, that would mean that within the wound is both the capacity for hurt and the capacity for healing. And as I say, you have to kind of feel your way into this, because I bet everybody in the room has wounds, physical, moral, we have political wounds, we have spiritual wounds, we have all kinds of wounds. This is a play that's meditating about the very possibility of healing and reincorporation from that separation, that tragic separation that a wound levels at us, and reintegration into being a part in a positive building way that reintegration with the community can do. Interestingly, the poet seems to be suggesting that the stage, the play, the rhyme gives us the vehicle to this healing.
At the end of the play, Hercules urges Philoctetes to act with courage. Go, Philoctetes, with this boy. Go and be cured and capture Troy. Asclepius will make you whole, relieve your body and your soul. Go with your bow. Conclude the sore and cruel stalemate of our war. Win by fair combat, but know to shun reprisal killings when that's done. Then take just spoils and sail at last out of the bad dream of your past. Make sacrifice, burn spoils to me, shoot arrows in my memory. And Neoptolemus, you must be his twin in arms and archery, marauding lions on that shore, Troy's nemesis and last nightmare. But when the city's being sacked, preserve the shrines, show God's respect. Reverence for the gods survives our individual mortal lives. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.